The 26th head football coach of this great institution. Ladies and gentlemen, our new head football coach, Mel Tucker.
Our team, we will be physical.
Wilkins again gives to Benjamin. Hick dropped in the backfield. Mustafa Johnson shooting through for Colorado.
Sometimes you just know. And I know that the young men in that room, they're hungry.
An interception thrown by Martinez. It's picked off by guess who? Nate Landman.
I've never been in a game as a player or a coach that we weren't expected to win.
Blitz from Nebraska. Montez takes a shot. Drops it in to Chenault. Touchdown.
Welcome back to episode 13 of the Shoulder to Shoulder podcast. And the Buffs have stopped the losing streak, took down Stanford 16-13. And we will get into that right after we go through the Pac-12 recap, which started with Washington in one of the ugliest games I've ever seen. And it was actually, I don't know which one was uglier between our game and the Washington-Oregon State game, but it was an extremely ugly game to watch.
Yeah, I mean, there were more picks in Washington-Oregon State, so maybe you could lean that direction. But, yeah, man, I don't know. It was not a great game for either offense by any means. I think that Washington defense kind of showed that they're a very, very talented squad. But, you know, Jacob Eason was straight up bad. And the Oregon State offense with Luton was not any better, considering they had, oh gosh, let's see. I mean, he had 88 yards passing, which is just obscenely bad. So
on
bad.
19 completions too.
Yeah, and they had 119 total yards. So Washington really dominated this game. I mean, it was a 19-7 win, but based on yardage, like, Washington had 420 total yards of offense and Oregon State had 119. So Oregon State's only touchdown was a defensive one off of an interception from Jacob Eason, so that kind of tells you what this game looked like. I just think Washington was by far the more talented team. Salvon Ahmed really kind of bailed out Eason, I feel like, in that game, and they were able to pull out the win, but it wasn't pretty by any means.
Yeah, Ahmed was about the only guy that looked competent in this game. I mean, even Eason was, looking at the stats, he was 16 for 32, 175 yards and two picks.
Bad. I mean, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think all the talk about him being a potential NFL guy is kind of starting to fade away. He's probably going to have to come back another year because he's just looked, I mean, he's looked good a lot of the time, but not like to the point where I would be comfortable drafting him if I'm a GM.
No, I mean, he has the tools. He has a good arm. I mean, it's kind of like Montez, actually. I mean, he has the physical gifts, but for whatever reason, he doesn't seem to show up every time. So it's hard to say what you're going to get with him week to week.
And he does this amazing backpedal thing when he feels pressure that is eerily similar to Montez spinning out of the pocket. And it's amazing to watch because I think it might even be a worse reaction than spinning out of the pocket. He just straight up backpedals.
Yeah, so, I mean, it wasn't looking good for their offense. But their defense took on an Oregon State offense that has been putting up all kinds of points and really shut it down. I mean, Luton, like I said, he had 88 yards on 28 passing attempts and an interception, so he was couldn't do anything. And Isaiah Hodgins has pretty much been tearing up everybody, only had 33 yards and four receptions. So credit to the Washington defense. They were great. Washington offense, not so much.
Yeah. Oregon State, I think Oregon State fans have a lot to be confident and excited about going forward, but it's got to be a confidence dampener when you have 8 second half yards and not a single second half first down.
Yeah, that's ugly. I mean, look, like we said, they got dominated. There's no other way around it. I know it was only a 19-7 win, but they just, on offense, Oregon State couldn't get anything going, and it never really felt like they had a shot to win this game. And yeah, I mean, they needed something different, and maybe down the line it'll get better, but it wasn't a good feeling for them. I think going up against a defense that's actually got some serious talent and is really quality by any means.
Yeah. So that one, Washington again, hasn't looked that great this year. They're 6-4 now on the year, but they still, I mean, they showed in this game that they just had superior talent all over the field.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, you know, like you said, it wasn't pretty, and it doesn't look as bad as it was, but it was 19-7. It should have been 19-0 if it weren't for a stupid Jacob Eason interception that got returned back to like the 7-yard line. So,
right.
So the next game up on the docket was USC against Arizona State. USC won 31-26, and Arizona State kind of seems like they are regressing almost every week. But to be fair, Jaden Daniels did not play this game. I'm not sure exactly why he didn't play, but he was out, and Joey Yellen came in and actually played pretty well considering he was the backup.
Yeah, so I guess Jaden Daniels, he had practiced like as late as Wednesday, I think. So I don't know if he sustained an injury sometime in between Wednesday and the day of their game, but he wasn't playing, and USC really jumped on him on this one. I mean, they were up 28-7. I think at one point, Keaton Slovis had like one incompletion in his first 15 pass attempts or something ridiculous like that, and USC was just scoring at will. And to ASU's credit, it slowed down a lot, and they were able to make this game close. They were able to make it interesting. So, you know, I guess for me, I'm kind of like, I don't know what it says about either team. I think USC is still the same team that almost lost to CU in Boulder, and ASU, you know, you're right. They've definitely been regressing as time has gone on. They looked like they were on the upswing after we played them in Tempe there, but it does seem like they're struggling a bit. They're sitting at 5-4, so they still haven't qualified for a bowl quite yet, and it's kind of where a lot of those middling Pac-12 teams are. You know, you don't know if they're going to win any given week. You don't know which one of those teams is going to show up any given week.
Yeah. The crazy thing about this game too is Keaton Slovis threw all four of his touchdowns, and I want to say 390 yards of his passing in the first half.
Right. Yeah. He went like, off he did, early. Yeah.
Yeah. He did. Then he did nothing really for the rest of the game. So, I mean, when you throw for that many yards and touchdowns, you shouldn't have to do anything. It seems like maybe they kind of slowed down and became maybe uninterested because they had such a big lead at the end of the first half. It was 28-13, and they, you know, like we had just mentioned, they dominated the first half offensively. So I think they kind of just got a little overconfident and almost threw the game away.
I mean, look, at the end of the first quarter, it was 28-7, I believe, and they only had 31 points by the time the game was over. So, I mean, after they scored their last touchdown, their drives were punt, interception, punt, turnover on downs, field goal, fumble, punt, 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 end of the game. So they definitely, I don't know if they took their foot off the gas or ASU just calmed down and kind of figured out what they were doing on offense, but it wasn't what I would call a great showing. I wouldn't say it saved Clay Helton's job by any means, but they, you know, they took control early, at least. I'll give them that. They took control early, but they were really hanging on for dear life by the end of that game. And if it wasn't for an interception on the last drive for ASU, I mean, we could be talking about a huge ASU comeback this week instead of a loss.
Mm-hmm. And that would have, I mean, like you said, I think Clay Helton's pretty much done. I mean, for those of you that don't know, CU fans might remember Mike Bone, who was the athletic director that hired Embry, Hawkins, and McIntyre. And
Big winner.
Yeah, he doesn't have a special place in my heart, but he is now the new athletic director at SC, and him and the president were pretty much openly talking about coaching searches the last week while he was being hired. Right. So, I mean, I kind of feel bad for Clay Helton because he's sitting there in his job and they're just openly talking about him getting replaced. So,
right. Yeah. USC is going to be different by the time next year rolls around for sure.
Yeah, I just really hope it's not Urban Meyer. I can't stand the guy, and he would do really well there. So
yeah, it'd make me sad.
So look for Joey Yellen to be in the transfer portal after a good showing this year.
Yeah, maybe.
I don't think he's going to want to back up Jaden Daniels after he showed that he can play at the Pac-12 or at the Power 5 level. So we'll see where he ends up. I'm assuming he'll transfer as well.
Yeah, probably. I mean, he's never going to play in front of Jaden Daniels at this point, I don't think. So
no.
We'll see where he goes. If he goes.
If he goes, that's a good point. So the game after that, Washington State lost to Cal, which was just exemplary of the Pac-12. I figured Washington State, even though they're going up against probably the second best passing defense in the country, I figured they'd still be able to get some points while Cal would score like once. And
exactly.
Cal figured out how to score with Devin Monster at quarterback.
I mean, look, I think the key to this one is Washington State's run defense is really bad. I mean, when we played Washington State, we saw we could run when we wanted to. Granted, we didn't do it enough, but
no,
we could. And I think Cal's whole thing is they have to run the ball because you can't rely on Monster to throw the thing all over the field. Granted, Washington State did their thing. They passed. They still had, you know, 423 yards total offense. So they still were solid on offense, but I just think Cal made the game what they wanted it to be. They ran the ball. They did what they wanted to do on offense, and that defense is still good. And if they get some support from their offense, which they got plenty in this game, you saw that they can still be a quality team.
Yeah. Cal is the kind of team with Justin Wilcox as their head coach that freaks me out in the sense that if they get a competent offensive coordinator, they're going to be really tough to stop because he's going to have that defense rolling every year. And if they can just get somebody to make their offense even average, it'll be a hard task for anybody in the North to beat him and anyone in the South when they go up against him in the future.
Right. It feels like they're not that far away. I mean, honestly, just getting Chase Garbers back from injury, I feel like this team's totally different. I mean, they were kind of starting to get on a roll before he got hurt. And then he got hurt and Mod started to come in. It's been a serious adjustment ever since then. I mean, they were 4-0, remember, at the beginning of the year. They're 5-4 now. So yeah,
they're the number 15 team in the country.
Right. It has not been good since they had to make that switch. And that's definitely been the biggest difference. And, you know, it makes me curious about how they're going to be in the next few years. But you're right. It does feel like they're just one move, one tweak, maybe one big quarterback recruit away from being like a serious threat in the conference.
Yeah, I really wouldn't be surprised if Cal fires their offensive coordinator, Bo Baldwin, at the end of this year, just because I think he's been there 3 years now, and they've never been good on offense. So no, I think never. It's probably time to show them the door.
Never. I mean, they've been like better if they didn't play offense in past years. So
yeah, they really have.
I feel like it wouldn't be that hard to get an upgrade there, and I feel like they should be looking for it for sure.
Yeah. So that wraps up the Pac-12. Both Utah and Oregon, the only playoff hopes remaining, have a bye. And we will kind of get into their playoff hopes a little bit more in detail next week, since we won't have a CU game to recap. But, you know, just from this week, Alabama and Penn State both lost. So, I mean, you knew LSU or Alabama was going to lose. I don't think many people expected Penn State to lose.
No, that came out of nowhere.
Yeah, I mean, we'll see. I could totally see the committee doing something ridiculous, like moving Alabama to 4 and either keeping LSU the same or moving them ahead of Ohio State. But I would assume if they are realistic and reasonable, they would move Alabama and Penn State out. And so, you know, we'll have two new top 4 teams.
If I had to guess, I would think Penn State probably falls behind Oregon and possibly Utah as well. I think Alabama probably ends up 4, and I think your top 4 is going to be LSU, Penn State, Clemson, or not Penn State, excuse me, LSU, Clemson, Alabama, and Ohio State, I think will be in your top 4. Obviously, LSU number 1 or 2, Ohio State 1 or 2, and then Clemson's probably 3 and Alabama's probably 4. I just think it's hard for the committee to let go of Alabama, which is kind of like the worst possible spot for them to be for the Pac-12. And
Yeah.
We'll get into it next week, but I have a feeling that's where they're going to end up. So, I don't know. It'll be interesting to see how it goes down the line. I mean, it's not a guarantee that Alabama doesn't lose another game. They still have Auburn to play. I believe LSU still has to play Auburn as well. So, there's still a lot that could happen going forward. I mean, even Minnesota, after pulling off that great game against Penn State, they still have to play both Wisconsin and Iowa. So, who knows? There's still enough weeks left, enough games left, that it could look totally different before the playoff is officially decided. But, you know, all Oregon and Utah can do is keep winning their games and hope they meet in that championship game, both of them with one loss, and the winner makes it. But who knows?
Yeah, I think at this point, the winner, if they were to stay undefeated, or not undefeated, but if they were to win out from here, the winner of that game is going to be in, but the issue is getting them to that point.
Yeah, and if they're not going to be in off of that win, there's going to be some serious discussion coming afterwards about the structure of the playoff, because I think there's going to be a lot of like viable arguments about this team that's a champion of the Big 12 should be in with one loss, or this team that's a champion of the Pac-12 should be in for one loss, but this team that's in the SEC, you know, even though they had one loss but they didn't play in the championship game, like, there's going to be a lot going on there, so it's going to be interesting to see.
Yeah, well, I have a feeling that when it comes down to like the end of the season, we're going to start hearing an argument from the Alabama side that, well, if Tua had been 100%.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's like, going to get real frustrating.
Like I said last week, my worst nightmare, LSU beats Alabama close and they can say, oh, Tua wasn't 100%. So that's not fair. And now you're looking at two SEC teams in the playoff again, which I feel like should never happen. If you have your top four teams, like, you got to win that game against LSU, period, if you want to be in the playoff. That's it. End of story. But I get it. I get the arguments for everyone. I think it should just expand. But that's a discussion for another podcast, I guess.
Definitely. So we'll move on to the game that we were most excited about, the Stanford Buffs game. Buffs come out on top 16-13. This one was also kind of an ugly game. But I mean, realistically, I really do love the ugly games. Like, back when SEC teams were having like 9-6 wins, I loved that. But, you know, this is very similar. CU drove down and scored on its very first possession, and that was the last touchdown they'd have.
Yeah. So we can just, we'll rip the Band-Aid off. We'll get into the bad stuff first, I guess, before we get into the good things about this game. But yeah, I mean, plain and simple, the play calling was definitely frustrating at times for the offense. I mean, like you said, they went down the field, they scored on the first play, on the first drive. And I mean, Fontenot looked like he couldn't be stopped on that first drive. The offensive line was just pushing people around. I mean, Montez scored the touchdown on a keeper, which was good to see. I mean, they really kind of put it all together on that first drive. I think they had to convert one third down. I mean, nothing crazy, and Fontenot got it easy, so it was really a good possession. And the rest of the game, it just seemed like there was something missing on every drive, and we were talking about it a little bit during the game. You know, Fontenot was just killing this team, and he ended up with, I think, 18 carries for like 95 yards or something like that.
Or 18 for 95.
18 for 95. So his average was very strong, 5.3 yards per carry. And I get you want to mix it up, but if one guy is just dominating the other team, I would like to see him get at least like 25 carries, which doesn't seem like that big of a difference. But when you think about each drive, I mean, they're really like one play away from getting some of those to go a little better. So, you know, I would have liked to see him get more touches. I mean, Jaron Mangum, I think he's going to be a really solid player for us in the future, but he had a rough game this week and wasn't getting much going. Not that it was his fault every time. I mean, he had a few runs where there were guys just meeting him in the backfield before he could do anything. But yeah, I mean, basically what it comes down to is the play calling on offense. It's just, it was a little bit frustrating at times. There was some lack of execution. The KD not catching a touchdown in the end zone at the end of the game. I don't know. You were in the stadium, so you had a different view of that one. But
yeah, to me, it looked like he threw it and KD just like watched it go right by him and didn't even like make an attempt at it. That's how it looked from my I mean, where I sit, I was basically perpendicular with the end zone on the play where the like the ball was thrown, and it looked like KD didn't even really make an effort, but I couldn't tell exactly how close it was, and I think you saw something a little different.
Yeah, so from the broadcast point of view, it looked like Montez threw the ball. There was some discussion about maybe it was tipped at the line. It's kind of hard to tell, but either way, I mean, the thing was close to him, and he had his hands reached out like he was going to catch it, and then he pulled his arms away, like put his arms up in the air, like I don't even know how to describe that, like he thought he made a mistake by trying to touch the ball, which is weird to me. Like, you would think he would just try and catch it, but there was some discussion about maybe he thought it was meant for someone else. But obviously, you know, there was no one behind him. He was the only receiver in the area. He was the only person in the area. If he had caught the ball, it would have been a walk-in touchdown. And there was some discussion afterwards, you could tell, where he was kind of explaining himself to people. But it looked like there was just some confusion about, because it was kind of a broken play. Montez was trying to make something happen. But he did. He looked like, from the broadcast point of view, it looked like he reached out for the ball and then changed his mind. And he kind of put both his hands up like he wasn't supposed to touch it at all. And it just fell incomplete.
Yeah. And yeah, it was just a weird overall play, I guess. I can't be too mad at Montez, I guess, since, you know, I've watched the replay. It looked like it was definitely catchable.
Yeah. But I mean, it would have been, you would have had to stretch out, but a little bit, but it was definitely, I would consider it catchable. I wouldn't even consider, like, if he had caught it, I don't even know if I would have thought, like, oh, wow, that was a good catch. You know, I would have just thought.
Yeah, just like a routine play.
Yeah, right. So.
Yeah. You know, I don't know. It happens.
It's tough, and it's only really a bummer. I mean, now that they won, it's fine. It's only really a bummer because it would have made the offense look like it had a little bit of a better day, you know, if you if you score that touchdown, but it's hard to say for sure, you know, what the game would have looked like, because Stanford would have been trying for more points and all that stuff. So
yeah, right, yeah. I mean, not to rag on KD even more, but can we stop with the KD Wildcat, please?
Yeah, I don't like it at all. I mean, Laviska Shenault is a specimen, and KD, like, don't get me wrong, I think he's athletic and he's talented, but it's not the same level. I mean, you saw it. Laviska Shenault converted a fourth down play on their last drive where he was met at the line of scrimmage, and he just absolutely sent a guy into the afterlife and gained another 5 yards after that. So that's why you run the Wildcat with him, even though that wasn't a Wildcat play. I just mean, in general, that's why you run the Wildcat with him. Because, you know, even if he gets hit before the line of scrimmage, he's probably getting another yard or two guaranteed.
Yeah. I mean, I don't have any like stats or anything in front of me, but I'd be willing to bet if you ran the Wildcat with Visca needing, like, if it was like a third or a fourth down and short, I would bet he's in like the high 90% conversion rate on running that play.
I can't even remember a time when he hasn't gotten it, to be completely honest. If it's within a yard, I feel like he's got to be 100%. But that actually, I guess that was the other thing. Why do we not, every time it's third and a yard or fourth and a yard, why do we not just run a quarterback sneak on every one of those plays?
Yeah, we did it one time, right? And that was it.
I understand you want to be unpredictable, but like, you get a little too cute when you have Tony Brown act like he's running a sweep and then fake back to the inside, have absolutely no momentum, and then, of course, get tackled a yard behind the line of scrimmage. Like, they ran that play once when I just wanted them. Like, every time Montez quarterback sneaks it, he gets like 3 or 4 yards because he's huge. He's huge. And the offensive line could just fall forward and they get it, you know? And yeah. I just feel like we make it a little bit too complicated sometimes, which hopefully that gets worked out, you know, at some point in the future, if not this year, next year. But it seemed like every time they decided to do that, it was a guarantee for sure.
Yeah. If it's like a 1 yard or less, if you only need one yard or less, I think the only plays you should ever run are Visca Wildcat, quarterback sneak, or maybe a halfback, like a dive inside if you have been running the ball well that day.
Right, right. But even but, that is yeah. tough. Yeah.
I mean, there's. It's just, I feel like the success rate of running a sneak is going to be so much higher than handing it off in any situation.
Yeah, I mean, you would think so. Like, I guess I don't even have the numbers to back that up, but it just felt to me like it just couldn't be stopped. I mean, we have like one of the bigger quarterbacks in the Pac-12, so he just kind of falls forward and he makes it happen. And I don't know, that just seems like easy money to me personally. So
mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, in years past, the line would get like had definitely had issues getting blown off the ball from the snap.
Sure, yeah.
That hasn't really been that much of an issue this year. So
no, you know. No, it definitely hasn't. I feel like the line play has been much better than what it was before. So I feel like that's something that you want to capitalize on. But
yeah. And you know, so I mean, little nitpicks here and there. Obviously, the offense could have a much better showing considering who they have as weapons. But I guess if you only need to put up 16 to win, it'll work. You just want to see it be a little bit more consistent with its scoring going
right.
forward.
Right. Yeah. I mean, we're nitpicking here, but you know, that's what we do. That's what we do. We look at the problems.
Yeah, and really the only other issue I had, aside from the execution and whatnot, was on that Dimitri Stanley, or not on that pick that Montez threw.
Yes.
Initially, I thought it was on Montez, but then when I rewatched it and you told me the exact same thing, it was actually on Dimitri Stanley running his route. Or the lack of running his route.
Yeah. So you could see for me, I'm with you. I watched it, and in real time, you're like, ah, oh, God damn it, he threw another one. You know. But you could see the thing that keyed me into it was as soon as the play was over, you could see Montez. And normally when he throws an interception, he just kind of runs off the field or whatever. But he looks at Dimitri Stanley and he's waving his arm, like kind of giving him a signal like, dude, keep running. Why did you stop running? Like kind of clearly frustrated. And the broadcast, they looked at it again and they were saying it looked like he just kind of stopped or slowed up on his route. And it allowed the corner, their safety, whoever actually ended up jumping in there, I'm not 100% sure, to make that play on that ball. And granted, I don't know. I mean, the way that he seemed to be reading Montez, if Stanley finishes that route, he might just be getting lit up as soon as he gets the ball, and it might be an incompletion. But we're still talking about a huge difference between an incompletion, getting to run another play, and giving up on the route and having an interception. And I don't know. I wasn't sure if Montez was going to feel comfortable going back to him later in the game, but I think he did. He gave him a couple more passes afterwards, so I think they'll be fine. I think it was just, you know, a mistake that happens in the game that, unfortunately, because Montez threw it there, everyone sees it and recognizes it, but I'm sure it'll get ironed out. I mean, Stanley's been like a pretty reliable receiver, especially on third downs this year, so I think it'll be okay.
Yeah, I mean, we got to remember Dimitri Stanley is only a redshirt freshman.
Right,
so
exactly.
He's still young. He's going to make issues like that. Cause, I mean, really, he ran a quick slant, which you're supposed to take a step, maybe two, and then cut at a 45-degree angle inside. And to me, instead of, like, stopping his route completely, it almost looked like he was going to cut it upfield.
Right, right.
Like, maybe, like, start to fade up a little bit more. And clearly, Montez did not expect him to do that.
Right.
Because like you said, if he runs the route correctly, what Montez thought was correctly, at least, that's an incompletion at worst.
Right.
So, exactly. You know, unless the guy makes an absolutely unreal catch for a pick, but
right.
So, you know, that's that one, I think that one's on Dimitri Stanley, but again, he is young, so I'm sure he'll figure that one out real quick, and he'll probably get some heat for it in film on, well, I guess Sunday.
Yeah, I'm sure, you know. That's how you got to do it, right? I mean, he's young. He'll hear about it a little bit, but he'll get over it. He won't do it again, and it'll be fine.
Yeah. So enough with the negatives. Let's get on to what actually went well this game. And can we talk about the fact that not only did the defense not give up 30 points, but they didn't even give up half of that?
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about, man. We talked a little bit after the game. And I was saying, you know, this is what I hoped for. This was like my brightest. This is what I was just dreaming about, that this defense, because I knew that they weren't going to be locked down guys everywhere. You know, they were going to give up yards no matter what. We knew they were young. We knew that they didn't have a lot of depth. I just wanted them to tighten it up in the red zone and not give up huge plays all the time and limit, like, hold drives to field goals, you know, and make plays when they could. Like, when they had long third downs, make those plays. And that is pretty much, to a T, what they ended up doing. I mean, Summers, to his credit, he called a solid game on defense. He seemed like he really was in control. Every time they got an obvious passing down, he was mixing up his pressures. They finally were getting pressure on the quarterback, and it was clear. I mean, Costello threw that pick to Rakestraw that he just got absolutely hammered on, and you just saw it come out of his hand, and you were like, oh God, that's going to someone on our team. I just know it. And Rakestraw was just the lucky guy who happened to be waiting on the other end. So that was really good to see.
Yeah. Costello, I mean, not only on that play, he got lit up by my count, I think four times.
Yeah, a few times. A few times.
I mean, he probably feels pretty sore right now. He got mauled a few times, and one of the guys that hit him a few times was Mustafa Johnson, who I think had his best game of the season since probably the Nebraska game.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah, he was getting a good rush going. It looked like his ankle was finally feeling better, so that was really good to see. And like you said, Summers called a pretty good game. I mean, he really hadn't been bringing a bunch of mixed pressure all year, aside from, I think it was like the USC game where he did it a couple times. Other than that, he hadn't really been doing it until this game where he, like, you could definitely see they were stunting. They were pulling late blitzes. They had, you know, jump back coverage on the zone where, like, they would show Davion Taylor about to blitz and then he'd hop back. It was really impressive to see, and I don't know if maybe they felt comfortable with the defense finally doing what the scheme is supposed to do, or if he just decided to kind of get a little bit more risky with it.
Yeah, I mean, for me, like, I think he probably just thought, what do I have to lose here, you know? So, and it's not like Stanford's offense had so many weapons that you think you're going to get beat one-on-one all day long. Like, that was the difference between Stanford and USC. Those USC receivers, if you leave your corners out there one-on-one, they're probably going to get burned. Whereas with Stanford, you really only have to worry about their tight end, Colby Parkinson, and the rest is kind of, you know, hit or miss, I guess. But, I mean, really, when you look at the numbers, KJ Costello, he only had 245 yards and a touchdown and an interception. And if you just factor in the fact that 75 of those or 73 of those came on one play, mm-hmm. where I think it was Nate Landman emptied out the middle. And honestly, I don't blame him too much because he decided to double up the most dynamic weapon on that team's offense in Colby Parkinson, and the middle just got left open. They ended up scoring. But I mean, that was really one big play. And if they didn't give that up, I mean, KJ Costello's day was pretty anemic, to be completely honest. So that was just really promising, really good to see. I was just so happy that they finally didn't give up 30 points, and then they didn't even give up 15. They ended up giving up 13, and it was huge. It was awesome.
Yeah, and actually on that play that
79
yeah. So what happened was, I mean, to be honest, Mark Perry got beat off the line. I mean, and to be fair, Sammy Fajoko is a quick guy. He's really fast. So he got beat off the line. And then, but he actually should have gotten hit by Onu. Onu should have been there to make the tackle.
Right,
but he got, like, tripped up following, I want to say it was Connor Weddington down the field, but I wasn't positive on that. He was following somebody on a seam route and then got tripped up coming back. And so, I mean, realistically, it should have been like a 25, 30 yard gain, but it was just, you know, he just almost fell down, and that's what sprung him loose. So, I mean, even then, like, it was kind of a fluky almost touchdown that should have just been a big gain. And so that's impressive that the defense was able to put that together.
Yeah. I mean, I think, like I said, I think this is what we were hoping for. I mean, not necessarily that, like, they only give up 13 points a game for their next two or whatever, but I just want to see you have some drives where if the team gets in the red zone, you kind of bow your back and you don't give up a touchdown. You only give up field goals. You know, you don't give up as many big plays throughout the game. Like, this is what I felt like the defense was capable of. They get the play in front of them. You know, Nate Landman's making tackles. Davion Taylor's making tackles. KJ Trujillo and Tariq Luckett are at least keeping the play in front of them. They're not letting these guys get deep behind them. And that's going to just limit big plays, explosive plays that have killed us throughout the year. So it was really good to see that. And it seemed sustainable, I think, because of all those things.
Yeah. I think my favorite thing about this defensive performance, and it wasn't the bend don't break, it wasn't the points allowed, it was that we had two true freshmen starting at corners because Delrick Abrams was out. We had KJ Trujillo and Tariq Luckett playing at corner. And they were targeted because, I mean, they're freshmen. They were targeted. And, I mean, they didn't really give up anything major. I mean, there were a couple plays that I missed. But, I mean, just looking at the stats Costello had, like you said, no one really had any major plays aside from Fajoko when he had that long score. I mean, those guys played pretty darn well against a senior quarterback who a lot of people thought was going to be top three in the Pac-12 at the beginning of this year.
Yeah, it was really good to see from the young guys who are still going to be on this team come next year and the year after. I mean, that's what you want to see, especially knowing that we'll have more corners coming back that aren't even playing right now that were supposed to be ahead of them on the depth chart. So it's good to see that there's going to be some competition, you know, with some of the recruiting stuff that we've got going on that we'll talk about later. It's looking promising for the CU defense in the future, which is great to see because it's been pretty brutal watching them getting torn up every single game this year. So hopefully they can keep it up for the last two. We'll see what happens.
Yeah. I mean, KJ Trujillo, I think, is very, very quickly becoming my favorite buff on the team now because, I mean, if we're being honest, this dude's 6 foot, 165. He might not even be 165. He, like we've mentioned before, he wasn't probably in the plans to be playing this year because he's just not like thick enough for a college player, but he's been thrown into the fire, and he, even at 165 pounds, he is not afraid to go up and make a tackle. No. And so, I mean, just get him another year in the strength and conditioning program, get him up to 180, 185. He's going to be a solid, solid corner for a few years to come.
Yeah, it seems like it. It definitely seems like it. And I'm holding out hope that that's true and he keeps progressing the way he seems to be progressing right now. I mean, supposedly he's been one of the most coachable players, according to some of the staff. So that's really good to hear. And you like to see young guys like that improving as time goes on, because if a defense can be our strength, I mean, that was Mel Tucker's goal from the beginning. So it would be great to see that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, you know, flipping it back to the offense, they actually had two really big-time drives at the end of the game, one field goal, one touchdown, that both were over 6 minutes long. And that's, I think, what really ended up putting this game away. It gave the defense some time to rest and get prepared to go back out there. And on top of that, it just melted the clock away so that, you know, Stanford, who was already not putting up points, didn't have much opportunity to do so.
Yeah, I mean, so It was good to see. I mean, we've talked about the struggles for the offense already today, but it was good to see that when it came down to it, I mean, Stanford scores this 74-yard touchdown drive, and they do it quickly, and they take the lead. And to see our offense respond with these two drives, the first one was 14 plays, 69 yards, 6 minutes.
Hey.
Six. Right. Nice. Nice.
Nice.
69 yards, 6 minutes and 31 seconds. And, you know, it could have ended in a touchdown, probably should have, but they get the field goal and then they force a three and out. And the next drive, I mean, they get this ball with 6 minutes left in the game and they just waste the whole thing, which is great to see. I remember last year, I think it was, they did that to Arizona State. They got the ball with a ton of clock left and they just hammered them into nothing for the last however many minutes. And you know, that's a good thing to see. I feel like that's when you start feeling like your team can be in control of these games or can win these games that maybe they shouldn't necessarily, because they can control the clock. So it really helped that defense. It kept Stanford off the field. I mean, you're talking about 12 and a half minutes. That's almost a quarter of the game right there. Mm-hmm. Where we just held the ball and just moved it down the field. Thanks to some, you know, some key plays, thanks to Laviska Shenault being not of this planet and, you know, a few other things, but it was good to see for sure.
Well, you know what they did on both of those drives, right?
They ran the shit out of the ball.
That, but they went for it on fourth.
Yes, they did.
Two
they did
times. That too.
Yep.
It was two times when in the past we have literally punted the ball. We didn't need to.
Yep.
Like fourth and one at the Stanford 31. That would have probably been a punt 2 weeks ago.
Oh, God. Yeah.
And then the other one was fourth and one at the 34. Definitely a punt 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
We went for it, and that's what won the game. Because I, as well as the defense played today, they probably would have given up a touchdown.
Oh.
Or something.
Yeah, I would have felt really bad if we had punted on either one of those, for sure.
Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, we went for it on fourth when we should have. We didn't punt when it was unnecessary. It just seemed like overall the game day management by Tucker and staff was a lot better, which, I mean, I don't think anybody expected him to be a flawless game day head coach. This is his first time really doing it full time, but at least he's showing he's not stuck in his ways and he's not, you know, stubborn about going for it on fourth or for not going for it on fourth, for lack of a better term. And he's actually willing to change how he calls a game going forward.
Right. I mean, well, I think the result of that, I think it's a combination of things. I think Mel Tucker has learned maybe being more aggressive, learned from his mistakes in the past, trusting that offense, which I did. Honestly, I felt like he called a great game. I don't know. I can't think of a time when he made a decision that I didn't agree with, to be completely honest, which was really good to see. And then the other thing was just when you talk about, like, okay, fourth and one at the Stanford 31, the play before, it was third and six at the Stanford 36. And you know what they did? They ran the freaking ball. And
yep.
That's because I think Jay Johnson decided, okay, last time we were in this situation, I didn't run it. I passed it. And we still had all those yards to make up in past games. So this time we're just going to run it. Fontenot's going to get us a good chunk, and it's going to make this fourth down easier to convert. So it just felt to me like they were more on the same page. They were more in line with, like, making good decisions and making the right choices, at least what I felt were the right choices, I guess. And, it made it easier for them. I mean, honestly, I feel like if we have fourth and one or third and one, we've got a lot of plays that we can use to make that thing happen between Montez sneaking, between Laviska out of the Wildcat, Laviska out of any sort of run whatsoever. I mean, Fontenot was killing him all game long. He could have run the ball. Like, I felt like that was a very doable situation for us. So it was good to see them work to get into those positions. It was good to see Mel Tucker saying, you have four downs to make this happen. So go ahead and do what you got to do.
Yeah, I will say, though, I did think it was a little odd on the last drive, after Fontenot had pretty much dominated the whole game, that they only ran Jaron Mangum when it was clear he wasn't really having his best day.
Yeah, so, I mean, that seems to be a game plan thing. I don't know if they're giving, because it seemed like they were alternating them. Like, when Mangum was in there, he was the only one in there. And when Fontenot was in there, he was the only one in there for the whole drive, basically. And they switched between drives. So I don't know if that's, like, they want to give him time to get in a rhythm. But I guess, yeah, I guess that's true. I'm with you. Last drive, you know, Fontenot has been tearing him apart all game long. Maybe you stick with him in the on the game-winning drive. But, you know, they made it work. So I guess you can't complain too much. But, yeah, I agree. I think Fontenot could have been in there at the end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But, you know, all in all, still a win. Still, it's all you can really ask for. I mean, as unrealistic as I think it is, they still are in bowl contention. So, I mean, Washington, right, yeah, to me is a beatable team.
Sure, yeah. At home, it's possible.
And it's going to be a Friday night game. It's probably going to be – or not Friday night game, Saturday. It's going to be a late – like a Saturday night game in the middle of November. I meant to say late November. our only two options right now for time slots are going to be 1:30 or 8 o'clock on Saturday.
Could be a national, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
So if it's an 8 o'clock game in November in Boulder, It's going to be cold. Washington isn't really used to the cold like that, you know.
Yeah.
It's like you said, it's a home game, and this team just plays different at home. So, I mean, they're a beatable team for sure.
Right, yeah. I mean, I'm not looking at that game like they have no chance. It's still, don't get me wrong, it would be an unbelievable upset for sure, because I still think Washington is a very solid team, but the season just hasn't kind of played out for them the way they want, because I feel like they struggle with consistency. And yeah, that could definitely play to our advantage. I mean, they come into Boulder. I mean, the stadium was friggin' packed for this last game, which was really cool to see considering the team's record and the struggles that they've had. And at least it looked like it on the broadcast. I guess I don't know how it felt.
Yeah, it was like 49,000 were in there at least.
Yeah, so that's definitely solid. And I feel like last home game of the year, it could be good numbers again. I think it's during Thanksgiving break or something for the students, so that's always that's always tough. But at least like the bulk of general population of Boulder could show up there and make it pretty rowdy, so that would be good to see. I think they've got a chance, honestly. I mean, I have some positive feelings towards that game that I definitely wouldn't have had before this week, considering the way it went.
Yeah. So, yeah, we'll break that game down a little bit more next week when we come back, and we'll go through the Pac-12 and then preview the Washington game next week. But before we move on, was there anyone else that we didn't mention that kind of stood out to you from this game?
Let's see. I mean, we talked a lot about Fontenot. He was a beast. Laviska Shenault, obviously. I mean, one more time, I got to touch on that play on fourth down that he made. I mean, I was audibly in my house. I was like, oh, damn it. He didn't get it. And then he just flattened another man into the ground and gained like another 5 yards after that, which was amazing to see. I mean, I don't care what you have to say after this. If anyone thinks Laviska Shenault isn't just a seriously tough son of a bitch, then you're wrong, honestly, as far as I'm concerned, because he was battling through injury all game. He's been battling through it all year, but he clearly wants to be in there. He clearly wants the ball in his hands with the game on the line, and you know, he'll still take some punishment and he'll definitely deal it out. So that was great to see. But I know
go ahead.
I was just gonna say that was awesome to see, and I have the utmost respect for that guy. But besides those two, I was going to say, I know we talked about it a little bit, but I thought Davion Taylor played out of his mind this week.
Yeah, he has gotten very noticeably better in coverage as the years progressed. And for somebody that's as naturally athletic as he is, and remember, this is only like his fifth year of playing football.
Right.
No, fourth year. He's a senior.
Yeah,
well,
right. Yeah, he didn't.
I wonder if he redshirted his JUCO.
He didn't play full time. That's the point we're trying to make. Yeah, he didn't play like as much as everyone else did.
Yeah, I mean, he definitely was like on the high school team, but he wasn't allowed to play in the games because of his religion. So I mean, I mean, realistically, game speed stuff is still relatively new to him. 4 years in, and you can just see he's getting better in pass coverage every single game. And for somebody like I said, that's naturally that athletic, I think he'll get a shot in a camp. I don't know if he'll necessarily be drafted, but I think he'll get picked up by somebody, and he'll impress with his athleticism, and he'll probably land himself on a team.
Yeah, he'll get some looks for sure.
Yeah, so he was good. And what I was gonna say was that Laviska Shenault truck stick that he put on that guy, that was eerily similar to me. Of for a lot of you that are listening, if you are older CU fans, you might remember Lawrence Vickers. He got a ball, scored a touchdown, and a CSU guy was hanging on his arm.
Oh, the CSU guy.
He legitimately just threw him down. I'll find a link to it. We'll add it to the description of the podcast so you can go check it out.
Yeah, we'll include it.
Very, very similar types of plays to me. It was so impressive to see Laviska do that. I mean, he just basically made that guy his bitch for the night.
And pretty much.
It was amazing to see.
Ended him.
Oh, he did. But we can't go through this whole podcast without mentioning Evan Price.
Yeah, I know, right?
Evan Price, 3 for 3, the redshirt freshman. Obviously the last field goal, the game-winning field goal he made, it wasn't a tough one. It was pretty much right down the middle. But still, I mean, the redshirt freshman coming in, with that kind of pressure, and he just nailed it. Like, it wasn't, there wasn't a wobble in that kick. It wasn't off center. It was right down the middle, and he nailed it.
Yeah. Good from the moment it left his foot. They actually showed in the replay, you could even see he kicks it, and then he turns and he looks at, I think it's Alex Kinney, his holder.
Yeah, Kinney's the holder.
And he just looks at him, and he's got this big-ass smile on his face. And you know the ball is still traveling through the uprights. It's not even there yet, but he just knows he nailed it. And Kinney's, like, jumping on him already and stuff. I mean, that's just – that's what you watch sports for, you know, to see those moments where they come through. He's the freshman kicker, you know, filling in for Stefano, and that was – that was awesome to see. You're right. I mean, none of the kicks were crazy. I think 37 was the longest he hit the whole day. But, you know, I mean, he made all of them. So you can only make the kicks that are put in front of you, which was good to see. So him nailing it. I mean, speaking of Kinney, he crushed it. He had a 50-yard average on 4 punts, which, like, in a game that you win 16-13, your punter having a good day could honestly be the difference. And he had a really good day. So credit to that guy too.
Yeah, I mean, Kinney. I mean, I haven't been paying attention to the Ray guy watch list, but right. He's got to be near the top of that thing.
Yeah, he's got to be in there somewhere.
Nuts this year. I mean, every time we've needed a deep pin, he's gotten it, and then every time we are sitting back deep in our territory, he just hits bombs. So I mean, the guy is—he's a freak.
Yeah,
as a punter, yeah, for sure.
Which is funny to even talk about, but to be honest, like, I honestly feel like that was a big deal in this game. I mean, we were talking about a really low scoring game that the hidden numbers, you know, of punting and that kind of special team stuff can end up being a big deal, and I do think it was in this one. So
yeah, it definitely was. But that'll wrap up the Stanford recap. In recruiting news, before we get on to our other regular segments, we had 2 commitments today. Today is Tuesday, or not Tuesday, it's Monday the 11th. You'll probably be listening on Tuesday. We had Ashad Clayton, 4-star running back from Louisiana.
Yeah.
This guy had offers from Alabama, Michigan, you know, a ton of, like, I think Auburn was on there. I mean, he had so many LSU. He had so many good offers. And clearly, for the longest time, I thought that Mel Tucker was talking the talk, and he wasn't really walking the walk in recruiting. Thanks. Mel Tucker.
Yeah.
you know, he wasn't really walking the walk. Even as recently as a month ago. But with the way this game went, with all the visitors they had, and with all the talk you're hearing on all the paid sites like 247 and whatnot, it sounds like they're in line to finish huge. I mean, they got Ashad Clayton, the 4-star running back. They got Torin Pittman, who's a 3-star. He's listed as an outside linebacker from Texas. He actually plays a lot of safety, but he's going to be a perfect fit for the star role that Davion Taylor and Mark Perry play now.
Perfect.
Yeah. And then according to some of the sites, and I don't want to throw too much of the paid info out there right now, but I guess I'll let you go, Chase. Do you know, out of the other 3 guys that we're looking at here, what's been released for free from those sites?
For free, I'm not 100% sure. I can tell you there are some good feelings out there about Harris, the defensive end from Arizona, which is promising. There's also some good stuff out there about Gonzalez.
Yeah, Christian Gonzalez.
Christian Gonzalez, who is actually a Purdue commit, but, you know, I mean, things are looking promising. He was there this weekend, so after his visit, I mean, basically all I can say is the guys who have already been recruited, Brandon Rice, Carson Lee, Keith Miller, Lewis, all those guys, they've been recruiting their asses off with these guys that are here, and that's been super awesome to see. Obviously, Mel Tucker's having, like, a big impression on these guys who are coming in. I think Ashad Clayton said something after he committed today about you got there and you can tell. He was saying he could tell when a team really wanted him. And he could tell that when he got to Boulder, they really wanted him here. And it was genuine, and that was what he was looking for. So that was awesome to see that he got with the staff. He got with his future teammates and his teammates and was able to get that vibe of like, we want this guy here, we want you here, you're going to be a big deal. So I think that's really the biggest thing that I'm getting out of this is, A, there's sounds like there's more to come. I mean, I tweeted it out earlier today, but we were told by a few different people, at least on Twitter, we've got three coming. There were two that announced today, so we know there's some more coming in the future, supposedly. So it looks like this is going to come back. We're going to look back on this as a really, really huge weekend for the future of Colorado football.
Yeah, and one other name to keep your eye on is Jordan Berry. He's a defensive tackle from California. Berry. I know he's announcing on the 22nd his commitment because that's his mom's birthday, which she followed me on Twitter today, so shout out to her.
Hey!
And if you want to follow Chase and I on Twitter, we always tweet out recruiting updates and CU stuff, so you can follow me at Brett Magana and Chase at Chase V. Anderson. But you know, we'll be keeping tweets out up to date on that. But other than that, yeah, I mean, if this is what Mel Tucker can do when frankly the team's not having the greatest season, imagine what he can do if they get to a bowl next year, if they have a decent year next year, the year after that. I mean, this is what he's done so far. We're right now ranked the 35th national class.
Right.
What could he do if we have a solid season going?
Right. I mean, with more success, that image that he's trying to convey to them is only going to get easier and easier to see. So not to mention, we haven't even mentioned in this little thing here that they did also get Antonio Alfano as a transfer, which I think I saw some stuff online about if you include Alfano into this group, which obviously you can't do because he's a transfer, but regardless, if you include him into this group, we'd move up to something like in the 20s, which is awesome, obviously. I mean, he's going to be a game changer for him. It's just been really great this week where I feel like this kind of hope that we've had, I know the two of us for sure have had, where we've had this like positivity towards Mel Tucker and the staff and what they're doing. It's been great to actually see that kind of come to light and yield some results here, which, I mean, obviously being able to hope for the future of the program is awesome. Being able to have some like actual evidence, some actual proof that things are turning in the right direction.
Yeah. So, I mean, right now I think the class has 20 guys committed, so there's still room to add about five more. So, I mean, I'm not 100% on that number. I'm not looking at it right now. I'm almost positive they're at 20 right now. So they still have some room to add guys. So, you know, just keep an eye out. This class could end up top 35 in the country, which would be probably the best we've had since, you know, like a 2008, I don't even want to say his name, but Dan Hawkins class this year.
Yeah.
He had like a number 15 class, which turned out to be full of guys that just didn't pan out. I mean, the best player from that class is probably like Rodney Stewart, who was a two-star. So, you know, hopefully this class will turn out a lot better, and I think it will.
Yeah.
So with that being said, we'll get on to bets of the week. And Chase, as always, I'll let you start off with yours.
Okay. Bets of the week this week, really trying to turn our luck around here a little bit. This week, I have number one, Baylor plus 10 versus Oklahoma. Oklahoma, I feel like, is a team that has a lot of shine on it because of national perception, but I feel like they've kind of shown that they're just not quite as solid as people actually thought. Baylor, you know, I don't think they're going to go undefeated or anything crazy like that, but I think they've shown they're a good team, they're a solid team, and if you're going to give them 10 points, you know, I'm comfortable with that. I'm comfortable taking that against Oklahoma.
Mm-hmm.
I also believe, yes, it is at Baylor, so that kind of adds a little extra to it. I'm sure that the Baylor faithful will be going crazy for that one. So I think they keep it within 10 for sure. I don't know that they win, but I think they keep it within 10 for sure. My second game is Texas plus 7 versus Iowa State. The thing with the Big 12 is it's kind of similar to the Pac-12 in that these games have gone in ways that are a little bit unpredictable and they feel kind of strange. I just think that Texas has kind of lost some of that you know, Texas is back hype that it had in the beginning of the year. And I feel like that's causing it to swing way the other direction. So I'm going to go ahead and roll with Texas against Iowa State. Iowa State, they played a good game against Oklahoma, but like I said, I do feel like Oklahoma is kind of overhyped right now. So I'm going to take Texas going up against Iowa State. They're +7. I think they keep it closer than that. I think Iowa State, even if they are that good of a team, you know, they just had an emotional almost win against Oklahoma that they didn't pull out. So I like Texas in that one. And then my last one is LSU -21 versus Ole Miss. It's a lot of points, but as we saw with LSU against Alabama this last weekend, they can put up a ton of points on anybody. I don't care who you are. And as far as I'm concerned, Ole Miss's offense is not going to be anywhere near what Alabama's offense is, even with a Tua that's not 100%. I mean, those receivers are just too good. So I think LSU is going to come in there and they're going to really dominate Ole Miss. I think they're going to be fired up. They're probably going to have the number one ranking in the country, if not number two behind Ohio State. And they're going to be really fired up. I think Coach O is going to have them ready to go, as we're going to see here. pretty soon with some of his words after that win, but I think they're going to be ready to go. I think they're going to win that one easy, and they're going to cover those 21 points.
Wait, Chase, you're saying that they're going to dominate a Mike McIntyre-led defense?
Yes, that's exactly what I'm saying. I think they're going to make Mike McIntyre's defense cry on the sideline with their unstoppable force. That's what I think it is.
That's... You know, one thing I want to mention with Oklahoma, I think the offense is as good as advertised,
sure.
But the defense, I think everyone thought that, now I'm blanking on his name, but the old Washington State defensive coordinator who went to Ohio State, but he came in and he was going to like work magic with that defense. But I think it's just kind of showing that Oklahoma's defense is just really not there yet. And I think he'll get them there, but... In Alex Grinch, that's what his name is.
Right.
I think
right.
They'll get him there, but I just don't know. I don't know if it's a talent thing. I don't pay enough close attention to Oklahoma's recruiting rankings to know if they just don't have defensive talent, but something is up there. And, you know, if they can get that defense figured out even a little bit, that offense is always going to be good under Lincoln Riley. So,
right. It is. And I was going to say one more thing with the Ole Miss and LSU thing. Ole Miss. I think that defense is benefiting from the fact that they play in the SEC. And as much as everyone thinks the SEC is like the pinnacle of college football, it's not the pinnacle of college football for offenses. If you look at Auburn's offense, is not exactly dominant. Texas A&M, same thing. Vanderbilt, same thing. They played Cal and they gave up 28 points. So the only real offense they played was Alabama, and they gave up 59 points. And I think LSU's offense is better than that. So good luck stopping Joe Burrow. That's my bet, is good luck keeping Joe Burrow from absolutely torching you.
Yeah, at this rate, Joe Burrow will win the Heisman.
Yeah, pretty much.
He is on a complete terror.
He's the front runner for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so my three bets for the week, starting it off, Minnesota is somehow an underdog. It's in Ames, Iowa. But Ames is Iowa State.
Yeah,
Des Moines.
Almost. Yeah.
Are they in Des Moines?
God,
now I feel stupid.
I don't. Is it
that
like
doesn't sound right?
Iowa City or something like that.
Regardless, it's at Iowa.
It's in the University of Iowa. Yeah.
Yeah, it's the University of Iowa, which I have to look it up now. I feel like this is why you shouldn't listen to me for my advice. I would just listen to Chase. Chase knows everything.
Oh, look at that. I got it right.
But anyways, the reason I'm picking Minnesota, they played Penn State last week and pretty much from the get-go dominated the game. I mean, the score was pretty close, but I watched a lot of it, and Minnesota really I never really had any doubt that Minnesota was going to win that game from the start. And so to see that they're not favored against an Iowa team that's meh. I mean, they're good, but their offense is pretty terrible, and Minnesota has shown it can put up some points. I have a feeling that Minnesota is going to either win this game or it's going to be like a 1-2-point game at the end at the very least. So I'm pretty confident in Minnesota. I think they showed that they're a lot better than the people thought they would be. And so I'll take Minnesota plus three all day right now. Next one I'm going to take, Wake Forest plus 33 at Clemson. It's in Clemson, but, you know, Wake Forest is one of, like, 2.5 good ACC teams outside of Clemson.
Yeah.
And 33 points is a lot to give up. I mean, Clemson has been dominant, but, you know, this is going to be one of the only real tests that they have on their schedule right this year. Aside from, I mean, they had Texas A&M, who turned out to be not that great. So, I mean, this is going to be a team. I still think Clemson will blow them out, but I'm thinking somewhere in like the 3 to 4 touchdown range, not all nearly 5. So I'll take Wake Forest there. And then my last one, sticking with what I usually do, and I actually found out today Nebraska is 1-8 against the spread. Nice. I'm taking Wisconsin minus 14 against Lincoln. I mean, for anyone that even remotely follows what the college football in general, Wisconsin has obliterated Nebraska many times since they came into the Big Ten. So when I see this at minus 14, that Wisconsin team, even though they have that loss, they are still a pretty good team. And they're going to smoke a very bad Nebraska team. I have the utmost confidence that this will be a 3, 4, or 5 touchdown margin of victory here for Wisconsin. So I'll take Wisconsin with the points, or Wisconsin down the points in Lincoln.
Yeah, I think Jonathan Taylor's going to run all over Nebraska pretty much. So that'll be fun to
see. Jonathan Taylor has had his way with Nebraska since he came here.
Yeah, that's going to be fun.
Yeah. So that'll cover the bets of the week. And as Chase alluded to earlier, this is our tweet of the week. There's not really much to say. I'll just kind of play the video. And this one was from, there were a lot of people that had it. The one I found was from at AlanBell247. And I will say right now, if there are kids in the room, maybe turn it down.
You understand that?
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
So obviously Eddie O was a little hyped up after they beat Alabama and got a little aggressive with it. I think the best part about it too was hearing his like response to it after someone questioned him about it today. He was like, yeah, he shouldn't have played it, but I get caught up in the emotions. Go Tigers.
Yeah, pretty much.
So
I mean, so that was Coach O is awesome, man. I honestly feel like I really like that guy. You could just tell, like, he has a bleeding heart for all of his players. So it was good to see LSU win that one. Honestly, I was rooting for him the whole way, not gonna lie.
Yeah, especially since we had them both covering the spread.
Yes, that's true too. But even aside from the bets, I do feel like it was just good to see LSU come out on top over Alabama for the first time in, like, what'd they say, like 11 years or something ridiculous like that?
It was something pretty crazy, which I didn't realize it'd been that long, because it seemed like every time they played, it was always like a nail biter.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that was good to see. And, yeah, I was telling Chase before we started recording, I think Eddie O might be my favorite college coach outside of anybody that's at CU.
Outside of Mel T himself.
Yeah, so it was good to see him get that fired up, and that was hilarious when that was making the rounds on Twitter.
Yeah, that was good to see.
So, yeah, that'll do it for this week's podcast. We'll be back next week to preview Washington, and we'll also update on any recruiting news if something happens between now and then.
Yeah, you can follow us on Twitter, because I know Brett and I will either be tweeting, retweeting, liking, whatever recruiting stuff we can find. Subscribe to the podcast. Leave some ratings, some 5 stars, please. Some comments. We'd love to see them. And as always, Sco Buffs.
Sco Buffs.